Acts chapter 2. Well, I was going to say, he who endures to the end shall be saved, which sure cuts out our other evangelist, doesn't it? Well, you don't you tell him I said that. Yeah, I was going to just truck right through, not give you a break at all, but then I found out this other evangelist that's going to speak at 11 o'clock gets upset if somebody takes his time, so it's awful to be a split personality. Acts chapter 2, I really want to get into the rest of the chapter a little bit with you. We have been going over in this Bible study the Pentecost event, which is verse 1 through 4, and been describing it. We're into the consequence now, which is verse 4 of the event itself. We saw the context of the event in giving us the atmosphere and the setting in which it took place. We examined something of the content in chapter 2, verse 2 and 3, which is a focus, of course, upon the rushing mighty wind, the sound as of a rushing mighty wind, which is the whole echo idea, telling us that this is a movement of God, the very heart of God that's come to be within us, which is just an awesome concept flowing through our very inner being. And verse 3 then, the content is this sitting, this we have become a platform for Him to demonstrate His greatness and that whole concept. And then the consequences of that is verse 4. And of course, the first thing He went after, the Spirit of God, when He indwelt man, the first thing He went after was the tongue, the speaking. As you look from verse 5, down through the rest of the chapter, you'll notice it becomes very evident that the whole chapter is laid out in a contrast. It's a contrast between two groups of people. Now, you have to read it several times and saturate it in a bit to see that. Not that it's hidden, but it isn't as obvious as it might have been. And the reason it isn't so obvious is because one group of people, there's only two verses given to them. He goes right over the top of them. It's like they don't exist. It's like, I'm not going to mess with you. It's like, hey, I've done all I'm going to do for you. The other group, all the material from verse 5 down through verse 47 is given to this other group except for two verses. So if you don't pay attention, you miss this other group. But there's this contrast between these two groups. We're going to call the groups, just for identification's sake, the scriptures in this particular passage doesn't relate these titles, but this is who they are. Over on the one side, we're going to put the Jews of the dispersion. Now again, that title's not used in the passage, but it is used in the scriptures itself. For instance, over in John, Jesus said, I'm going to go away and you won't be able to find me. And the Jews said, oh, I wonder if he's going to go to the Jews of the dispersion and hide. So they used the term. So this was a familiar term for their day. The epistles, a couple of the epistles, I think it's James and maybe it's Peter, I don't know, Peter, is addressed to the Jews of the dispersion. So you've got this group over here we're calling the Jews of the dispersion. Then over on this side, we're going to call them the Jews of Jerusalem. And the contrast is established between the two. Most of the chapter is dedicated to the Jews of the dispersion. Now they're described for us in verse 5. The Jews of the dispersion, there were dwelling in Jerusalem Jews, devout men from every nation under heaven. Which is a pretty definite description. It's a little misleading, the fact they were dwelling in Jerusalem. They didn't really live in Jerusalem. Well, they did live in Jerusalem. Well, no, they didn't. Well, they were the original snowbirds. You know, you go to this guy in Florida and shake his hand and say, hey, how are you? Where are you from? Michigan. Oh, you are down here on vacation. No, I live down here. I thought you said you lived in Michigan. Well, I do. Well, you live down here. No, I have a house over there. Well, you don't. Do you? What? Which? It's both. See, that's this group. Now, what I want you to get about this group is that all the way through the chapter, you get this feeling from this group that they're, that there's a characteristic about them. And he really goes overboard to demonstrate this to you, that they're open and they're seeking and they're desiring. See, they are probably Jews that are, most of them would have been a result of the exiles. You remember in the Old Testament, 12 tribes of Israel, 10 went into exile, never came back. Never came back. Well, they didn't just disappear. They're all out there. And even Judah, the southern two tribes, they went into exile, Babylonian captivity, and a lot of them didn't come back. So here's these Jews that are out there in the exile, have stayed in these major towns all across the world. And of course they clustered together. And the amazing thing about the Jew is that they would put their money together and build a synagogue in the town. In fact, as you begin to study this, it really becomes significant, because these Jews were the beachhead for the evangelism of the early church. See, they'd already established in the town, in this foreign land, already established in this major town, a synagogue and the testimony and witness that there's one God and He's sending a Messiah. Whoa! Then Paul goes on his missionary journey, and the first thing he always did is he stomped right down there to the synagogue and he preached. And of course, they kicked him out, so he went next door and started a Church of the Nazarene. Just kidding. He did. He went right next door and planted a church, right next to the synagogue. So this was the beachhead. There was already this awareness in the town of one God and a Messiah to come. So this was the beachhead. It's also this group that was responsible for the translation. Oh, this is really significant. Probably won't thrill you, but it was the translation of the Old Testament Hebrew Bible into the Greek language of their day. They're responsible for that. They demanded it. And a whole group of them got together in Alexandria and they translated this thing. And when you come to the New Testament and you see quotations from the Old Testament, it's always from that Greek text. We call it the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Old Testament. So that came out of this group. So this is a phenomenal group, folks. So they've clustered together in these foreign towns. If you study history, you'll find out that there were more people living out, more Jews living outside the Holy Land than were living inside the Holy Land at this time. They don't know how many because there was no way to count them. So there's all these Jews that are out there. Now, at that time, if you again read the historians, at that time, in that period of time, there was this awareness, there was this all over the world, there was this excitement, this awareness, this feeling. People had this sense that there was something big about to happen. Of course, if you were a Jew, you would believe that God is going to do something big. So there was this anticipation. We should be able to identify with that. You know how it was at the turn of the century. The Y2K, we're all going to lose our money. Oh, the computers are all going to crash. Planes are going to come out of the sky. Whoa, it's going to be. And we all, what's going to happen? We were all anticipating. What a letdown. Because nothing happened. But that feeling, see, it was all over the world. That's what's going on in this hour. So there was this feeling that something big is about to happen. Now these Jews here that we're talking about, the Jews of the dispersion, they said, oh, if something big is going to happen, God's going to do it. Where would He do it? Jerusalem. Where would He do it in Jerusalem? The temple. So they came to the temple every year, packed their bags, put their money where their mouth is, bought condominiums down by the temple, man. They hung around for 2 or 3 months, basically during the feast days, and they were there anticipating, sitting on the edge of the seat, longing and excited, wanting God to do something new. They're just anticipating, longing, getting into this. Wow, I wonder if it'll be this year. What will it be? God's going to do a new thing. Now, if God does a new thing, this is deep. Probably haven't seen it before. Wouldn't be new. See, if God's going to do a new thing, probably haven't seen it before. So they're looking for this new thing. Oh, what's the new thing? What's the new thing? God's going to do a new thing. And they're anticipating. Now, there's another group over here. Jews of Jerusalem. They are identified for you in verse 13. Oh, by the way, the Jews of the dispersion are 15 different nationalities. They're listed for you in verse 9, 10, and 11. And I would read them for you, but I can't pronounce them. And if you get bored with this, you can just count them up to be sure I'm right. But there's 15 of them listed there. So these are the Jews of the dispersion. Now, in verse 13, there's this other group we're calling the Jews of Jerusalem. And they're introduced to you just in verse 13. Others mocking said. Now, the grammar is very specific there, in the Greek language. It's not, well, there's this, all these Jews of the dispersion, and there's a handful in every crowd, you know. They're spotted throughout the crowd, a bunch of guys that are trying to sleep through the sermon or something. You know, they're just always somebody. No, that's not what he's saying here. He says there's two distinct groups going on here. It's in the grammar. Two distinct groups. Over here on this side, you've got the Jews of the dispersion. Over here, you've got an entirely different group that are not a part of this. It's not several people spotted in this group. It's no, this group, and now you got this group, and you got the mockers. Now, it's not hard to figure out who the mockers are. All you have to do is go through the Gospels, and the ones who are attributed with the idea of mocking are leaders of Israel at the cross. Chief priests and scribes and Pharisees mocking him said. So it's all the way through the Gospels. The mockers are the leaders of Israel. So over here you've got the Jews of the dispersion. They live in foreign cities. They've come sitting on the edge of the seat, longing, anxious. Oh, God's going to do a new thing. What will it be? Over here you've got the Jews of Jerusalem, the leaders of Israel. We've always been here. My great, 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 great grandfather went into exile, but he came back and we've never left since. They know the back streets. They turn the lights off and on at the sanctuary, down at the temple. They light the candles. They keep the thing operating. All of Jerusalem is a result of their dedication, faithfulness. They run the show. They're on the Sanhedrin. They got the act down. They know what to do. They're the stable, never left. You guys come in 3 months. You're gone. Go away. Just leave your money. Here we are. Now, they're locked down. They're narrow. They're traditional. They're the ones that stand up in the board meeting saying, we've always done it this way. They are protective, guarding. Nothing's going to disturb. Over here, sitting on the edge of the seat, whoa, God's going to do a new thing. Wonder what it'll be. Wow. Over here. Two groups. Now, here's what's so significant about the chapter. God comes and does a new thing. Pentecost. Oh, this group. Whoa, this is the new thing. Wow, look at this. And they begin to ask questions. What does this mean to my life? How do I... And you know what God does? He goes overboard. You've got to admit, as you look at the chapter, it's laughable. It's just, you just slap your knee and say, good night. God just went wild with getting through to this group. I mean, it's just overwhelming. For instance, this group, he said, okay, Jews of the dispersion, I'm going to have disciples who are Galileans and can hardly talk their own language, as I've already said. And I'm going to cause them to talk in 15 different dialects, your dialects, that they don't even know. What? He didn't need to do that. You understand he didn't need to do that. And don't say, well, they needed the message. No, 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 no. In fact, they didn't give the message. There was no preaching in that. In fact, if you go down to verse 11. If you go down to verse 11, this is the only indication we have of what they said. We hear them speaking in our own tongue the wonderful works of God. In other words, it was a testimony kind of time. They're just dancing around, having a big time, talking in 15 different languages, saying, whoa, isn't God good? Wow, God did this, God did that. And they're not addressing, preaching, giving four spiritual laws, trying to have an altar call type of thing. It's just a praise session. And these Jews are all standing around. And you realize that when Peter stood up and preached, he only preached in one language. Because they all knew one language. So it wasn't like these Jews couldn't get the message if God didn't have disciples speak in tongues. That isn't true. So Peter stands up, preaches in one message, in one language, and they all got the message. So God is just saying, I'm just going to go overboard. And God just went overboard and had 15 different dialects spoken, which just blew him away. And then he said, hey, hang on. And he got Peter and said, moved on Peter. And Peter stood up and said, I'm going to have Peter preach this long sermon, and he's going to explain this whole thing to you. So God just went overboard to get through to this group. Now, how did he treat this group over here? Well, there's only one verse dedicated to him. And it's verse 15. In Peter's sermon, he gave one verse to this group and then forgot about them. These are not drunk as you suppose, since it's only the third hour of the day. That's it. Now, I want you to look at that verse and say, what deep spiritual revelation comes from that? There isn't any. Peter stands up and says, oh, you guys are brain dead. You're saying these boys are drunk? They're not drunk. It's only 9 a.m. in the morning. And even a Jewish alcoholic isn't going to be drunk on 9 a.m. in the morning on a feast day. So it's strictly an intellectual approach saying, you guys, off your wall. Don't, come on, wow. What are you doing? Now, the key to verse 15 is the word suppose. These are not drunk as you suppose. Suppose is a Greek word the Greek word there that's translated suppose is only used five times in the New Testament. And it is the idea of under, two words put together basically, under and to take. So when the Jews came up with the idea, well, they're drunk. When they came up with that idea, where did they get that idea? Oh, it says they went under and they took, meaning they turned inside. See, they turned inside, went down inside to their own thought process, their own understanding, their own interpretation, what they've always thought, grabbed a hold of, pulled out, and said, oh, our conclusion is they're drunk. From our framework, from the way we feel, from our tradition, from what we know to this point, they're drunk. What's going on with this group over here, the Jews of the dispersion? Whoa, God, what are you doing? We want in on it. God, what's happening? What's going on in this group over here? What's going on this group over here? Whoa. This group? What group are you in? Now, isn't it interesting? God just, on this group, just wiped them out, just ignore them, just go, hey, go to your committee meeting. Just forgot about them. This group over here, he goes absolutely overboard to reveal. It's a little more serious than you think. This group over here turns into themselves and says, they're drunk. Now, what are they really saying? Well, let's analyze. Where does drunkenness come from? The devil. So what they're really saying is, you think this is a result of God? This is not God doing a new thing. This is the devil. And they attributed to the devil the works of God. Right? It's exactly what they did. Now, I thought about that. And you're already way ahead of me, aren't you? And I asked myself the question, have they ever done that before? You remember in Matthew 9? Jesus healed this, was doing all these miracles, and the mute man, and the guy spoke, and they said, oh, the crowds went wild. And he said, now, you don't understand. He's doing it by the power of the rulers of the devil. Rulers of the demon. The ruler of the demons. In chapter 9. In chapter 12 of Matthew, you sure remember this one. Again, he just did this, all these miracles and all this stuff was going on, and it finally cast out one demon, and the crowds just went ballistic. I mean, they just, whoa. And a wave just went through the crowd. Could this be the Son of David? Could this be the Son of David? Is this one we're really looking for? And these same guys stood up and said, wait a minute, kid. He does this by Beelzebub, the prince of the demons. And it was at that occasion, you'll remember, that Jesus looked at this crowd and said, let me talk to you about the unpardonable sin. The sin that cannot be forgiven. There's a sin God can't forgive? Yes. Well, what is it so I won't do it? No, you're not getting this. It's not a deed. It's an attitude. And what's the attitude? Well, this isn't of God. This is of the devil. God is doing something and they attribute it to the devil. Now, they've done that twice. In fact, you remember the crucifixion. Think about this. This is serious. Think about this. The crucifixion took place. And these same guys are... God is doing the biggest deal. His son is nailed to a tree. The blood of Christ going to change the generations of time, folks. Whoa. God is doubling up his fist, socking the devil square in the eye. He's giving him a blow he'll never get over. The generations of people from the beginning, all into the future, are all going to be changed because of this one single event on a cross. And you know what these guys are saying? Well, if you're really the Son of God, and not of the devil, you'd get yourself down here. But obviously you're not getting down here, so there must be, where there's fire, where there's smoke, there's fire. I bet he's done, well, you don't get into this kind of situation with that. And they're basically saying, this is not of God. If this was of God, he wouldn't be up there. So this must be of the devil. In fact, you remember the resurrection. When the soldiers had passed out for fear, because the angel had come down, this is so significant. They finally revived, and it says they ran into Jerusalem. And you know who they went to? Leaders of Israel. They didn't go to their boss, Pilate. They went to the leaders of Israel. They were Roman soldiers. They went to leaders because they knew the real boss was the leaders of Israel. So they went to the leaders of Israel, and it says they told all that had happened. Can you see them? Bright lights, angels, whoa, earthquake, whoa, the body's gone, wow, something's going on. And they just, you know what these boys did? These guys right here, you know what they did, folks? You know what they did? They called a committee meeting. They got around a big oak table. And it says they consulted together, meaning they put their heads together. Can you see them all leaning forward around this oak table? They're all leaning forward, looking at each other, saying, what are we going to do about this? You know what they decided to do? They decided to take money out of the treasure and pay the soldiers off and tell them to go out and lie. And what was the lie? You go out and tell everybody that the disciples stole the body. Who's responsible for stealing? The devil. So they're saying the resurrection is not because Jesus raised from the dead. God, no. This is not an act of God. This is an act of a bunch of disciples sponsored by the devil stealing a dead body and spreading a lie. So, what have you got? Miracles? It's of the devil. Miracles? It's of the devil. Crucifixion? It's of the devil. Resurrection? It's of the devil. Now, here's Pentecost. They're drunk. This group is, this really hit me hard. Because do you realize, if every time God does something new, I attribute it to the devil, how would he ever talk to me? In other words, God can't do anything that I haven't already seen him do. He can't do anything that isn't in my tradition. He can't do anything that doesn't fit up, that doesn't fit neatly with my theology. He can't say anything that I don't already know. He can't give me any new truth because I won't believe it because it'll be the devil talking to me. Then man, you're locked down, aren't you? So God is never going to write a new song. Never going to reach a new generation. Because every time he does it, that's the devil. Why? Because I haven't seen it before. What do you want to do with that? I'll tell you what I'm going to do with it. I'm going to get on the edge of my seat, brother. Hey, I'm not talking just about accepting everything that comes along. I'm talking about I'm going to get on the edge of my seat and say, God, I'm open. Man, I'm seeking you. Because God is doing new things in this hour, folks. That's the chapter. And God goes overboard. It's just so impressive. Overboard to get through to this group of the Jews of the dispersion, because they're open and they're seeking. So God says, hey, I'm going to prove this to you, man. I'm going to go after this thing and prove it. And so he goes, well, let me show you. Verse 5 down through verse 12. Look at this. Luke says, now Luke is writing this. Luke says, I am going to exhaust the Greek language. I'm going to use every conceivable word I can get a hold of to show you what's going on inside of this group, the Jews of the dispersion, their openness and their seeking. I'm just going to go after it, and I'm going to use every Greek word I can possibly come up with. And he uses five, he does it five times. Now he duplicates once, so there's four different Greek words describing the response of this group over here. It's really interesting. For instance, verse 6. When this sound occurred, the multitude came together and were bewildered. I don't know what your translation says. My translation really says confused. I think yours says, NIV says bewildered. But the Greek word is really interesting. The Greek word is, again, two words put together, to pour and to mix. So it's basically, I'm thoroughly mixed up. That's his description of him. So can you see this group? We're talking about the Jews of the dispersion. Can you see this group? Their eyes bug out. Their mouth is wide open. Their chin is on their chest. And they're looking at each other saying, whoa, I'm thoroughly mixed up. Did you see that? God is just blowing them out of the water. He just knocked their socks off. I mean, Pentecost has happened, and there's this sound as of a rushing mighty wind, and all of this has taken place, and they're seeing these disciples, and then 15 different languages are being spoken by a bunch of Galileans who can hardly talk their own language, and these guys are going, whoa, I'm thoroughly mixed up. What is going on? Now, that wouldn't be too impressive if it was just once. But go down to verse 7. And they were all amazed. There it is again. Another word, amazed. Amazed is the Greek word that literally means to misplace. And it's the word that's used for being crazy. Out of your mind. I misplaced my mind. That's the word. It's used over, I think it's in Mark, when Jesus is preaching. And the house is full, and it says that Jesus' mother and his half-brothers came to the house to get him because they thought he was needed some quiet time, because they thought he was, this word, out of his mind. That's the word. So can you see this group? Their eyes are bugged out. Their mouth is wide open. Chin's on their chest. They're saying, whoa, I'm thoroughly mixed up. I'm out of my mind. That's this group. Now he adds to that in verse 7 a third word. So you got this bewildered thing, the amazed thing, and marveled. Now marveled doesn't give you any new information, but it's in the imperfect tense, which tells you it happened in the past and has continual action into the present and future. So what that means is that this was not a passing thing. This went on and on and on and on. So the emphasis here is that they stopped and talked about it. This is not like you drive down the highway. Whoa, there's a wreck. Well, you slow down, look at it, then you're gone. No, this is they stopped, got out, talked about it, and they begin to discuss it among themselves. So here's a group of people. Their eyes are bugged out. Their mouth is wide open. Their chin's on their chest. They're going, whoa, wow, I'm thoroughly mixed up. I'm out of my mind. mind. Did you see that? I've never seen it. What on earth is going on? What's happening? Is this the new thing? And they begin to discuss it. There's three words. Now go down to verse 12 and he gives us two more words. He duplicates the word amazed in verse 12, which again is out of your mind. And then he uses the word and perplexed. Perplexed is a good translation. But this word here in the Greek for perplexed has a prefix on it, which is the prefix thoroughly. So it's a beefed up version of being perplexed. It's not just, whoa, I'm a little perplexed. No, not a little perplexed. This is, whoa, I'm thoroughly perplexed. This is a beefed up version. So what do you got? You got this group of people talking about the Jews of the dispersion. Luke says, I want to try to describe what's going on inside of them. What God has done has literally just rocked their boat, shaken them at the core. I mean, their eyes are bugged out. Their mouth is wide open. Their chin is on their chest. They're saying, whoa, I'm thoroughly mixed up. I'm out of my mind. Did you see that? Never seen anything like this. Whoa, I'm out of my mind. I'm thoroughly perplexed. See, it's really strong in the passage. Now, let me ask you a question. Have you ever had anybody you'd like to do that to? Have you ever taught a Sunday school class, and while you were teaching the class, you just wished that that crowd would just go, wow! Never heard anything like that. Wow, did you? Could this be true? Isn't this? This is going to change. Oh, my. Have you got a teenager at home? You make him come to church. He comes in. He gets out and ticks during the service. He ain't paying attention. He doesn't give a rip. He's bored out of his gourd. Look on his face. Doesn't sing the songs. Wouldn't you just like to go up to him? Wouldn't you like God just to do something so big and so phenomenal the guy would just go, whoa! Wouldn't you just like to give him a shock in his behind side that he just jumped to his feet and go, whoa! What is God doing? Oh. Hey, I'm not on anybody's case. I'm just, wow. Your county's just like ours. You got a camp meeting here? How many churches do you have in your county? If an eighth of all the churches attended, church attendance on Sunday morning would come to your camp, you'd be jammed. You'd have to build a new tabernacle, wouldn't you? Well, why don't they come? Why do people drive right down our main street? I mean, look over and see our church. They just drive right on. They just... Psst, psst, psst. I went to this little town. Hold a revival meeting. This was the Church of the Nazarene. Went to this little town to be in this Church of the Nazarene. It had a filling station. There was kind of a paint, hardware, grocery type store. And a bar. And that was it. And I pulled into the filling station. This is before GPSs. Pulled into the filling station and said, hey, I'm looking for the Church of the Nazarene. And the guy said, never heard of it. I said, well, it's supposed to be one right here in town. Town's not that big. That's right. I never heard of it. I said, how long you lived here? I'm born and raised here. He said, let me ask this guy in here. So he went in, huh, came back out. No, no Church of the Nazarene here. No, no, there's some churches around, but no Church of the Nazarene. I said, well, thanks. Got in the car, looked both ways before I went out on the main highway, the main road there. Looked this way. There it was on the corner. We hadn't made enough noise in that town to even let anybody know we were there. We hadn't even made anybody mad. Nobody knew we existed. We're starting this practical ministry school. One of the things we're after in training young men and young women is get into the town, man. Well, I'm going to go pastor this such and such a church. Okay, so you come to this such and such a church. When you come to this such and such a church to be the pastor, oh, I'm pastor of First Church. Okay, right here you are. Well, what's your congregation like? Well, I got these adults and I got these kids and I got these and I got to figure out how I'm going to, and oh, I got to go to the hospital and visit them and we got to, and it's all. What if you came to town and said, oh, you've come to town to be a pastor? Yeah, I'm a pastor of the Lebanon town. I'm a pastor of Butler, Georgia. I attend this church over here, but I'm a pastor of this town. In our town, 25,000 people in our town. And not one single pastor in the Kiwanis Club, not one single pastor in the Rotary Club, not one single pastor involved in the Chamber of Commerce. Because we're all... Are you upset about this, Manly? Yes! This is... Wouldn't you like to take your town and just have God do something so... Whoa! Wouldn't you like God just to move and just, wouldn't you like something to happen that your town would just be, whoa! What's going on? Did you see what's happening? Whoa! Now, if you have any desire for anything like that to take place, which is what happened in this passage, if you have any desire for that, let me suggest to you an idea. Number one, the inspiration, it's in the passage, the inspiration of the amazement. What is it that amazed them? How are we going to get this done in our community? Well, let's see if we, what if we had a quartet? Well, we saw some folks that hung around for a little while. It upped our average attendance, didn't it? So would you say that's working? Well, let's get a slick evangelist. Obviously, that doesn't work. What's it going to take, folks? I know what we'll do. Let's get up a... Well, let's have athletics at our church. Not against that. Upward basketball. Not against that. Great program. Whoa. But do you think you can compete with the athletic program of the schools? Well, let's get a band for the young people. You haven't got enough money, son, to get the kind of band there. In the Church of the Nazarene, they changed programs for the youth in the general church. And they decided instead of trying to affect all the world, they would affect regions. So each region had its own youth program every 4 years. They had a gathering every 4 years. So this was the first time in the United States and Canada. It was really going to be a big deal. Oh, they were going to have 4,000 to 5,000 teenagers get together for a week. Oh, it's going to be, this is the first one. These guys really wanted it to shine. Oh, they just went after it. So, you know what they decided? They decided, we're going to kick this thing. This was back in 87. We're going to kick this thing off with a laser show. This laser show cost $10,000. It lasted 30 seconds. So here's the opening night. Lights go down. Shoo. Laser show. Shoo. 30 seconds. $10,000. And the teens looked at one another and said, "What was that?" "We've seen better than that in our barn." So did that work? So let me tell you, have you got enough money, enough brain power? Can you come up with enough programs? What can you get this done? Wowing your community? Obviously, you haven't. So folks, could we just all admit we're not going to do this? And there is no doubt in the passage, God pulled this off. That folks, we've only got one chance at wowing our community, and it's Jesus. We've only got one possibility. We've only got one thing to present to our community, and it's Jesus. It isn't going to be our bake sales. It isn't going to be our car washes. It isn't going to be our singing. It isn't going to be our preaching. It isn't going to be our buildings. It isn't going to be our... The secret is not... If we're going to shake our community and their eyes are going to bug out and their mouth is going to be open, their chin's going to be on their chest. Whoa! Wow! What did you see? I can't... The only way we're going to get that done is Jesus is going to have to do a new thing in us. Now, if we've concluded that, if you all agree with that, as it is in the passage, what's the instrument? Oh, this is so awesome. What's the instrument by which he's going to do it? He did it through the disciples! Come on, that's easy, isn't it, in the passage? He got 15 dialects spoken through a bunch of Galileans who could hardly talk their own language. And the instrument of the disciples, the instrument was the disciples. God wowed his... He didn't come in the clouds, come on. He didn't... This was not, whoa, God split a tree down the middle. This isn't, wow, earthquake took place. No! What wowed this crowd was the Galileans talking in 15 different languages. God did something in the disciples, through the disciples. Now, here's what I want you to get this. Did you notice he did not use their strong points, their abilities, their talents? He used their weaknesses. Because that's what wowed the crowd. The crowd looked at each other and said, "These are Galileans. They can hardly talk." And I'm hearing my own home language perfectly. As I told you yesterday, if these guys had had PhDs in language speaking, nobody would have been amazed. If these guys had had Saturday seminars on how to speak, nobody would have been impressed. But you know what impressed these guys? Whoa! It wasn't the talent of the disciples. It wasn't their amazing good looks. It wasn't their, whoa! They got together and formed a quartet. What amazed this crowd was what? They can't do this, and yet it's happening. What's going on? And God used their weakness to pull this off. About 30 years ago, I took a spiritual gift test. Some of you have had one. It's not a right or wrong. You can't flunk it. The purpose of the test is to find out what your spiritual gift is. I flunked it. I don't have a spiritual gift. Didn't have one. So I just pushed it aside and forgot it and went on. So when I got into this, I decided I'm gonna take another one. So I got Ellen to download two of them for me off the net. And I took two spiritual gift tests. I flunked both of them. I'm serious. Absolutely flunked both of them. I don't know whether I don't know how to take the, answer the questions. But when you look at a spiritual gift test, by the way, the word spiritual in the scriptures, the Greek word, means sourced by the Spirit. So a spiritual gift test would be a gift sourced by the Spirit. So when you look at the questions on a spiritual gift test go something like this. Would you rather watch TV and eat popcorn or invite 15 people over for supper? Would you rather go door to door in your community witnessing or take a nap? It's those kind of questions. And when you get done, they calculate all this up and you say, oh, you are good at hospitality. That's your spiritual gift, hospitality. Why? Because you would rather have people over for supper than watch TV. So hospitality is your comfort zone. What you're good at. What you like. What you feel you can do. So folks, it's not a spiritual gift test at all. It's a comfort level gift test. It shows you what you are good at. Now, we think that way in the church, and we came up with these tests to find out, oh, this is what you're good at, so this is what you should do. For instance, we need a teacher for the primary class. Oh, we've got an elementary teacher in our church. She would really be good to teach the primary kids. Yeah, oh yeah. You ought to go to her classroom and see how she fixes, she decorates, she knows how to put. Oh yeah, and she can hit a kid and not bruise him. So we really need her. See, we need her. You know? We really need her. Why? Because she's been trained and she's good at that. Well, now, I'm not saying she isn't good at that and that she wouldn't be good as a primary, but that's not a spiritual gift test. That's what I feel comfortable with. That's my talent level. That's what I'm... Isn't it interesting when God chose to shake, to amaze, to shock the living daylights out of a whole group of people, He didn't use what our talent is. He used what we're bad at. See, we're always saying, would you surrender your talents to Jesus? Well, wait a minute. Why don't you forget your talents? Would you surrender what you can't do to Jesus? And would you let Him do something in you that would just absolutely shock your community and say, them? They did. They... How far do you want to go with this? Nursery. Oh, I don't know. I've never been in the nursery. Dirty dog. No. No, 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 no. Not a bit interested. Not a bit interested. In fact, I'm old. I got arthritis. I can't handle kids. No, no. And they get on my nerves. I'm no, 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 no. Just a little insertion here. I was talking about this kind of thing in a local church, and my wife was in the congregation at that time and sitting right in front of a couple older ladies who were sitting right behind her, and she overheard those two older ladies talking. And one older lady said to the other lady, said, I don't care what he says. I'm not going to the nursery. Now, hey, it's fine. You don't have to go to the nursery. But look at the attitude. Whoa, whoa. They're drunk. You don't want that kind of attitude, do you? I was in a revival meeting. The pastor was going to sing a special with the lady who played the piano. She played the piano for how long? 80 years. So she's at the piano. They had this mic with a boom, you know, that came out. It had been pushed aside while she was playing the piano. So the pastor came down with his mic, and he joined her at the piano. He was standing by the piano. He took the mic on the boom and pushed it over in front of her while she was playing, getting ready to sing the special. She stopped playing, grabbed that boom, pushed it aside, went back to playing. He took the boom, pushed it in front of her, and she stopped playing, took that boom, pushed it. I'm not going to use that microphone. She doesn't have to use a microphone. Look at the attitude. Whoa. They're drunk. Look at the attitude. See, I don't care whether you go to the nursery or not. I don't care. I'm talking attitude here. And I'm telling you, if I've got the attitude of, that shuts God down, he gives me two verses and I'm gone. Over here, God goes overboard to shake my world and to, and wouldn't it be awful? I see this continually, folks. I'm on my knees to you. I see this continually. That the best people of our churches, the faithful saints of God who've prayed and been faithful to the church all their lives, come and say, we need revival. But they... and they don't understand that they are the very blockage of the movement of God we're trying to get done. Well, I don't do anything bad. I know. I serve the... I know. But it's this attitude that... it's in... we may go to noon. Oh, we got 5 minutes. So, let's wrap this up. Okay, in the passage then, God is responsible for the shaking of the world. He amazed this group. He did it through the disciples, and he did it through their weakness, not their strong points, not their talent, through their weakness. What was the intention? Why did God do that? Why did God come, do something through the disciples in their weakness that shocked the Jews of the dispersion? Oh, the intent is easy. Evangelism. 3,000 were saved and formed the base of the early church. So evangelism. Now, it's interesting that as you begin to go through the book of Acts, by the way, the book of Acts is not an instruction on evangelism. It's not an instruction on how to grow the church. It's not an instruction manual on evangelism. No, it's all about the movement of God. It's just the whole book is about how God moves. But you do discover a pattern. Here's the pattern. Starts here, goes all through the book of Acts. The pattern in the book of Acts is simply this. God just moves and does something phenomenal, just blows the crowd away, and then he always has somebody around who can stand up and say, let me explain to you what just happened. It was Jesus! And then people got saved. That's always the pattern in the book of Acts. For instance, in chapter 4, the gate beautiful, we already talked about it. Grabbed a hold of their hand, the preachers did, grabbed a hold of the hand of the crippled guy, yanked him to his feet, and God just, healed the man. And he's running around the tabernacle, and it says in Acts chapter 3 that the crowds were amazed out of their minds. Amazed. They watched, And Peter jumps up and says, let me tell you what's happening here. That guy running around there, it's Jesus, man, that did that. Jesus did that. And 5,000 got saved. Philippi jail scene. Bleeding backs. Stock. Hands in stock. Singing. Earthquake. Philippi jailer comes in. Hey, you want to know what's going on, don't you? Tell you. Jesus. A guy gets saved in his whole household. It's just again and again and again. So if you're hanging around your church saying, wonder why no one gets saved. First of all, you got to have this, so you can explain, Jesus. Well, how are we going to get the,
You got to be open, seeking.